danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 218 of the Thinking Poker Podcast, coming to you from Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm Darrow Kearney. I'm joined here right beside me by Andrew Brokus.
Yes, I also am here in Las Vegas, Nevada with Darrow Kearney, which is a great honor and pleasure.
And we're joined on the line by Nate Mavis. Bellows,
Massachusetts. Nate Mavis.
So yeah, Dara and I are roommates this summer, which I'm pretty excited about.
Me too, yeah.
And I know your summer's gotten off to a bit of a rough start.
Yeah, I had a tricky flight over. The main negative detail, let's say, was that my bag didn't manage to make it, and still actually hasn't appeared. I'm getting slow rolled by Virgin Atlantic. They keep ringing me, and then 30 seconds into the call, the line just goes dead. They've been promising me that the bag is 4 to 6 hours away for the last 24 hours, so I'm hoping to turn up.
so Dara, in poker, when you get slow rolled, I'm just trying to understand the metaphor. The two features are, first, that it takes a long time, and second, you lose. Is that what you fear in this case?
I think I'm definitely on a loser, because I just kind of saw briefly what my wife had bought for me to wear in Vegas this year, and it's pretty reprehensible, I have to say. So once it shows up, I'm going to have to actually start wearing these clothes. So,
I see. So you lose either way, is what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah. It's in fact, it's almost better if they just tell me that the bag is missing and they have to pay me to buy new clothes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite amusing today. He was wearing like a nice shirt inside of an off-white, like a cream sport coat, very very dapper looking, and then sandals.
Yeah, it was it's an interesting ensemble born of necessity.
Yeah, we are we're free on 4:30 this afternoon because the six max was today, and it's impossible to last more than 3 hours in a six max tournament.
Yeah, even when you add 50% to your stack very first hand, as I did, it's pretty much impossible to make the second break.
Yeah. So you guys both used your time very efficiently. You achieved your theoretical edge in just a couple hours.
That's one way of looking at it, yeah.
Yeah, it's... I always think of that, like, if the tournament pays 99 places, I think of busting the first hand as getting 100th place in the tournament.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's the absolute best outcome. But you probably need more distance than we have from the tournament. We were both kind of looking forward to the tournament. I think it's fair to say it too, because we
we fancy ourselves good shorthanded players,
rightly or wrongly. Yeah, and I have to say my table was absolutely amazing. So I felt particularly aggrieved to be the first person to bust.
Yeah,
mine was definitely not amazing. I mean, we started off with a good number. I would say probably like three amateurs and then two other professionals, one of whom was had a tilty streak to him that showed its head very quickly. So he was actually the first one eliminated from the table. And the amateurs were kind of tailboxes, but they kept, they just kept having big hands. So all I could to take advantage of the tails was to fold. But there was one in particular that I was real proud of, and I bragged about this on Twitter. I was kind of hoping people might guess or figure out how I was able to do this. But I really did correctly put somebody on pocket fives before the flop was dealt. Do you have an idea, Nate, of how one might do that?
Probably some sort of like old forum reference.
Nothing so complicated. It was just he had been dealt pocket fives twice already, and had shown it down both times. One of the times he flopped a set, and then when he looked at his cards, he sort of like smiled and kind of like chuckled to himself. And I was like, I think he's got fives again.
I
called, and there was a five on the flop. I mean, I just had middle pair on a three flush board with no draw, so I felt pretty comfortable just check folding that. And sure enough, he showed a set of fives. So I was pretty damn proud of myself for that one.
That's pretty
good. Yeah.
I suppose I could have three-bet him if I really wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, you should definitely call with any two if that's, like, unless the blinds are going to come along loose. Like, definitely if you think the other guy has fives a lot, there's no excuse for folding anything.
So. Yeah, it's pretty easy to play against a range that is just fives.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So, yeah, I'm not out in Las Vegas this year. Is poker dead yet? It sounds like no, but...
Based on a really small sample of just the two tournaments that I played, neither of which I made the second break, I would say poker is far from dead. Every year, I just feel that the gap between the professionals and the recreational players seems to grow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've deliberately targeted events that I expected to have soft fields, but I mean, no surprise, like the Colossus was full of people who were giving it away. The Venetian $1,100 MSPT event was also a very, very soft field. The tag team event was a lot of fun. I played that with Carlos. Definitely some people splashing around, having a good time in that one. And the six max was, at least in terms of the players I encountered, the toughest field, which is not surprising. But I mean, still, like half my table was amateur. So
good. That's it's always nice to hear. Save a little for me next year.
I will say, when I busted the six max, I went to play a 5-10 game at the Rio. That game was dusty as hell.
You tweeted about that. It was just like, it was a mix of like anonymous good players and like very famous good players.
One of whom, Michael Gagliano, has been a guest on our show. And we've even met in person, although I did not immediately recognize him in classic Andrew Brookes fashion. I don't know. I'm having fun. It seems like Dar is persevering despite his handicaps.
Yeah, no, I have to say, I was probably more apprehensive this year than in previous years coming over, because I've come for a longer spell this time than I have in previous years, and I'm also not taking a mid-series break. But once I got here, it was just like, yeah, it's great to be back. It's the best time of the year for a poker player, I think.
Just a reminder, Dara, you are allowed to take a mid-series break even if you don't leave the city of Las Vegas.
That's true. Well,
you're not actually compelled to play poker every day.
Well, I am going to pace myself. I mean, I didn't play yesterday, and I won't play again until tomorrow evening. So, I'm conscious of the fact that I don't want to be completely burned out. And if I do start to feel burned out 3 weeks in, I'll probably just take like a 3 or 4 day mini break anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, it's what I'm aiming for as well. This is the first time that I've tried to go start to finish for the whole series. So, you know, I didn't really feel bad giving myself permission to just come home. I mean, I guess I did, because I went and sat in a dusty 5-10 game for half an hour or so. But, just coming home when I finished playing at like 2 p.m. and just, and then I'm probably going to not, part of it is like, I do have a lot of coaching students right now, and I don't want to just, you know, be unavailable to them for 7 weeks. So it's sort of like, it's an easy excuse to take a day off. If I know there's people interested in coaching anyway, I can just do that instead. It doesn't necessarily feel like I'm wasting time or whatever, but yeah, I'm trying to go slow at the start of the series, because of course it, for the most part, just gets better as it goes on.
Sure, yeah. I'm hoping that none of my coaching students are listening, because I told them all I couldn't possibly coach them for the next few weeks, that it wasn't possible to combine the two. So Andrew's showing me up here.
So the people want to know, what's in the fridge right now?
For my part, mostly vegetables. I don't know. We went grocery shopping.
We went grocery shopping yesterday. Yeah, I got the absolute bare essentials: cereal, cheese, milk, yogurts, fruit. And that's pretty much it, yeah.
Olives.
Olives as well.
Seemed like a very French...
It's true. Yeah, it was quite continental. And bagels as well. Yeah.
Yeah,
my wife gets here in 3 weeks, and I expect the fridge to become very, very French when she gets here.
Very good.
I bought a six pack of beer when I got here, and there are also some beers in the fridge when I got here, I assume left from a previous tenant, but I haven't touched them yet, although come to think of it, this would be a fine time to touch one. Dar, are you interested?
Definitely, yeah.
I'll be right back.
I haven't actually had a beer since I got to Vegas yet.
You prefer a Heineken or a IPA?
Heineken, please.
Keep Nate busy.
So how are you feeling, Nate? I mean, do you feel sort of sadness now or nostalgia that you're not coming this year?
Very nostalgic. I'm sort of a nostalgic person, so I'm definitely thinking about the fact that I've been to every World Series that's been in the Rio ever.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, it's just since 2005, but still, you know, that's 11 of them.
That's a long time,
and,
yeah.
And now I'm, you know, I'm watching. So Jason Mercier just floated a check raise of Ryan Fees on an ace 6-4 board. And then Ryan turned a pair and check called a bet from Jason. And, like, this all seems very exciting. It's a heads up event.
Oh, yeah. So you're watching it's on Poker Go now or something this
Poker
year?
Poker Go, yeah. It's actually, like, the video quality is quite good. I miss David Tuckman. I think David Tuckman just did a really excellent job. So I miss it.
I agree. But, yeah, I agree completely. I was lucky enough to commentate with David a couple of times, and I was talking to Tatjana, who lines up the guest commentators this year, with a view to coming on. So I was really disappointed to hear that David's not involved this year. Well, he is involved, but not on the commentary side.
Yeah. And no, I just think he did a first-rate job. One of the most underrated people in poker media. But to answer your question, like, I'm not sad about it. I'm happy with what's going on, and you know, there's stuff going on in my life that prevents me from making it out, and it's all great. And that's that. You know, that said, poker's been, you know, a pretty significant part of my life for a long time now, and the World Series is something I really cherish. And you know, other things equal, it'd be great to be there, but other things are not equal. And poker, like, man, poker's around. I think there will be a World Series next year and in 10 years, and Foxwoods is down the road, and the Borgata is there. Like, there's tons of poker. Poker lasts a long time. It's all right, you know? And it is what it is. So it's very good to be talking to you guys, though.
Sure, yeah. No, I was saying to Andrew before, I was particularly disappointed to hear you weren't coming, because you're one of the people who seems to have the most positive attitude to the World Series, and it's almost infectious, your enthusiasm for it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. It's a shame. I certainly missed. I'll miss chatting with you. I know last year we only got a chance to chat a little bit during the tag team event when our better halves were both playing. So, but you know, no time to sweat our partners and talk about snooker this year, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm definitely conscious, Nate, of I feel like I'm playing for two this year. But I think it's been good. I mean, you've often been a good influence on me in terms of, like Dara said, the kind of infectious enjoyment of the whole process, not just the poker or the winning, but just sort of everything that's going on in Las Vegas right now. And I think your absence has caused me to be more proactive about trying to summon that up for myself. Although I guess I will say, in part, I'm thinking of my Twitter feed as a strategy to try to convince you to book a last-minute flight out here as well.
Yeah,
there's a bit of a long con going.
Yeah, you're very kind. Well, it's making for great Twitter content. It's just like, I mean, it's part of the magic of Las Vegas, right? It's like a parallel place, and like, you go there, and things that seem normal when you're there just are not normal. Like I don't know how much of this you caught, but I'll confess, I have Poker Go up as we're recording here, and like, Jason and Ryan Fee are playing heads up, and they're, you know, they're check raising and floating each other with nothing, and like, but like, they both look just ridiculous, and you have these people who look like somewhere between, like, you know, drug dealers or whatever, and much respect to both these people, but like, this is not like, they're gambling for tons of money, and this is not how, like, normal people, like, this is not normal. Nothing about this is natural, you know, and it's like beautiful and ridiculous at the same time. And again, nothing against either of those people, but like, it's just the Thunderdome is a very strange corner of the world, and it seems very normal when you're in Las Vegas, and it's not normal in the best possible way. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this applies to either of those two gentlemen, but I mean, I'm sure there are people who are professional poker players because prior drug convictions make it difficult for them to get traditional employment. I mean, that's definitely a thing.
When I was in today, I heard that U.S. Marshals came in and marched one of the dealers out in handcuffs.
Oh, wow.
There were no further details as to what he had actually done. But yeah, it does kind of back up the whole idea that there are some unsavory individuals wandering around the corridors in the Rio.
Yeah, I was playing some either 2040 or 4080 Hold'em at Borgata back in the day, and the guy next to me, he points one table over. He's like, "Yeah, you see that guy? He's a pimp." You know, I don't judge. I don't judge. It's fine. But, he's a pimp, and like the funny thing about that is that guy himself was actually a chaplain. So chaplain going out of his way to tell him that, you know, like, pimping, totally, you know, he doesn't judge. He's fine. It's all, yeah, no, a lot of people in the book.
Well, I've also had the good fortune of meeting a few of our former guests in person who were on my list of, and I've gotten to them very early in the series, but I definitely wanted to make sure that I met Jamie Kerstetter in person, which I've accomplished, and also that I've met Juliana Cornelius, and now can say that I've met both of those fine ladies.
Yeah, no, they're both fantastic. I met Juliana and her husband last year, and yeah, I only know a little bit about the husband, like what I gleaned in the 30 seconds we met, and he seems. I think they're well met. They're both so positive. He was like pumping my hand. It was like the happiest handshake I've ever had. You know, and it's like, he's sort of, yeah. I imagine if he has a Twitter feed, it's a lot like Juliana's, with a lot of emojis and a lot of like very positive energy.
Yeah, so. Emily was sort of teasing me about my spending, because I Juliana and I were both at Venetian, and they only give you a half hour for the dinner break, so we weren't actually going to eat on the dinner break, and my plan was just to sort of walk around with her for half an hour or so and get a bit of exercise and kill the time getting to know someone I wouldn't mind getting to know better. And Emily was sort of teasing me about spending my dinner break with a woman named Jules, who's always tweeting the emojis and all that sort of girly kind of stuff. But I think not that I had any illicit intentions, but I think it would actually be impossible to spend time alone with Juliana in any sort of poker context. She knows literally everyone. Like, we got very good walking in, because it was just constant, like, she had to stop and hug and chat with people. really did not go very far in half an hour.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. She certainly does know everyone, so.
She also promises that if we're not able to get an in-person podcast while she's out here in Las Vegas, that we can definitely do it in August. So hopefully we'll get her back on the show soon, one way or the other.
Sweet. Very good. Very good. I guess we haven't done a strategy segment yet. Does either of you have a hand you want to talk about?
I don't know, Dara, you had one that just came up today that you were sort of running past me. Do you want to
put that up? Yeah, I guess the most interesting hand I played in the 6-max, the blinds were 5,100, so it's level 2. Starting stack is 7.5K. I'm up to 9.5K when the hand starts. A fairly weak recreational player, min raises under the gun. He's been playing quite a lot of hands. He usually raises for a larger amount. This is his first min raise. I thought that probably had something to do with the fact that his stock was shorter. Now he was down to 4.5K.
Yeah.
And I have pocket queens next to act. So
yeah, that's already a decision.
Yeah.
I think either's fine. I think if he's been playing hands, the min raise is certainly a little bit scary, but I think in the 6-max setting, he's raising from an effectively late position. You have pocket queens. As they say, your hand is so much the nuts that you even beat other hands that are the nuts. I would re-raise, I think. And I like to just call it pocket queens more than most people do. So I'd be raised.
Yeah, and it seems like it's a spot where I'm not so much worried about him having something as, I mean, not that he couldn't, but like I think you can pretty comfortably get queens in against him if that's what it comes to. But it's more like how much strength are you going to be showing by 3-betting him. But it sounds like if he's an active player, like it's not like you would have to have queens. Like it sounds like he'd be a pretty decent you know, wide three betting target anyway. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah, I would certainly have three betting wider. My default at a full ring table would probably err on the side of calling this spot, but because we are six-handed and everybody's playing that bit looser, and we're effectively in later position because of the six-handed thing, I decided to three bet. So I made it 500. It got around to the big blind, who, in my opinion at least, was the only competent player at the table, and he was very competent in my view. He had also chipped up. He had about the same stack as I had, and he thought for a while, so he didn't act quickly, and he eventually flat calls, and then the original opener also calls. So 15-50 in the pot, three-way to the flop. The flop came 6-4-3 with two spades. I do not have the queen of spades. And it's checked to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. So if you bet, your hand looks a lot like what it is, I think. I think that the big blind's hand looks a lot like, you know, jacks or something like that. Maybe some ace-king, some ace-queen, maybe. But a lot of, like, medium pairs, I think, or, like, good pairs. I think probably a bet here will be perceived as pretty strong, not that you can't be bluffing. That said, your hand will benefit from protection once it gets back to the original raiser for 300 more. He's not folding anything, basically, given that price, unless he has, like, ace-nine offsuit, and even then he might not fold, even though he should. I think you should bet, but look to control the pot later, I think. This is not very sophisticated analysis. I don't know how much to bet, but I do think that you should bet. I'm not sure, especially if the big blind's good, I'm not sure how much you control the pot by checking. And yeah, so I would bet like roughly 40 to 50% of the pot, but beware that things could get pretty tough for you. In particular, your range is pretty capped, although that's only really deep enough to matter against one of your two opponents, whose range is also pretty capped. I'm not sure he's just calling there with like sixes, fours, threes.
I would question the designation as competent if he's cold calling sixes.
Yeah, I felt the big blind had absolutely no sets in his range. I thought the weakest pair he might ever call with might be eights, and he might not even call with eights. It might be nines plus. I didn't think he was completely capped in the sense that I thought he might sometimes trap with aces there.
Yes.
But yeah, to be honest, in terms of like really strong hands on that board, I was more worried about the original guy because I felt like he could have all the sets. He would say a lot of those weaker recreational players, when they have a small pair, they make a small raise. And then they'll obviously call the three bet because they're getting the set mining odds. So I felt he was a bigger concern in terms of having a really strong hand. I did feel, like you said, that the big blind typically has a hand like jacks or tens or maybe ace queen suited, ace king, those types of hands.
Yeah, no, I certainly think that the raiser can have all the sets, but the stack to pot ratio is like what, less than three against that guy, and
yeah.
He can also have like ace seven suited or whatever, all sorts of hot garbage. So not that you can blithely get it in against him, but I don't think you're exposing yourself against an uncapped range in a problematic way by betting, especially since like you have a lot more, over pairs that he doesn't have, and your queens beats a lot of his value range anyway. So I think I would bet. What do you think, Andrew?
I think that this is, it's an interesting, it's a good WSOP spot because it's like, it's a multi-way pot against one very good player and one probably not very good player. And so I think like, you can sort of play exploitively against the very bad, or not very bad, but I mean against the weaker player, without, I think at least in this case, exposing yourself to too much exploitation from the good player, which is always a concern. It's like, it's tempting to be extremely exploitive against the weaker players, but the better players can kind of see what you're doing and potentially re-exploit you. I think there's a common WSOP dynamic. I think here, though, because of, you know, you could just as easily have kings or aces as queens, and we're not really worried about this player. Like, it's not like the big blind has a nut advantage on you. Like, even if he could be flatting aces or kings, it's not like you couldn't have those hands. So I think you can just bet and, you know, hope that the big blind either calls or folds. Both of those things are fine for you, I think. I would probably prefer a fold, but I think, like, even if he calls, I don't think, you know, he has you beat 100% of the time or anything. Like, a lot of people, even good players, are not necessarily going to have the discipline to just check fold jacks there, even though he probably should. I think I would not be shocked, especially if you make a small bet, I would not be shocked if he just decides he's getting 4-1 and he's going to call with jacks once. Like, that's not... and then, I guess... I mean, if the original raiser, like, check raises tiny and looks really strong, I guess I could see folding to him. But, I mean, if you bet 600 or 700 and he shoves, it seems pretty plausible to me he could just have, like, an overpair or 6-5 or something like that. And I wouldn't feel too bad about getting it in against the original raiser.
If he shoves over that bet, I'm beating him in the pot. I mean, I'll stop and look and try to... And, you know, I'll take my time or whatever, but, like, yeah, that's an easy call, I think, not knowing anything else.
And I think it's like you said, Nate, you can't really control the pot by checking. Like, if the big blind has aces, he can still just bet as much as he wants on the next two streets. So what you are doing, though, is making it easier to realize equity, particularly if he has a live ace and or king in his hand. You know, he's not really going to make mistakes in the hand, I don't think. But he will, you know, you give him a chance to drill the ace of the king. So I actually think there's more of a case for making these kind of, I think there's less of a case for pot controlling in multi-way pots because there's more of an interest in protecting your hand, right? There's more danger of giving free cards. So I think you actually should probably play a little more straightforwardly in multi-way pots and do less sort of, like, checking with, you know, strong one pair kinds of hands that in a heads up pot it's a little safer to check those because you're less likely to get drawn out on.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I like that. So what did you do, Darryl?
Yeah, I do. I like that too. And in retrospect, I wish I had done that. my thinking in game was, first of all, I wasn't thrilled about the prospect of getting check raised by either player. I felt against the original raiser I would have to get it in and would be good often enough that it would be okay, but not a brilliant spot because I did feel that he could have all the sets. I wouldn't feel very good about getting it in against the big blind. So that was factor number one, fear of getting check raised. I also felt that my hand against the big blind specifically, given that I thought a lot of his range was like jacks, tens, nines, I didn't feel I was going to get three streets from those hands anyway. So I felt maybe I'll take the flop out and then I'll get turn in river from jacks, tens or nines without putting myself through the possible trauma of getting check raised. In retrospect, I think I probably overstated the fear of getting check raised. I don't think I'm getting check raised all that often on this board, and I do think it's important to deny equity because it's multi-way. I did in the end decide to check. After the hand, it was the one hand which really troubled me, so I ran it by the people that I normally talk hands with, and only one of them, only David Lappin, my chip race co-host, said he would check the flop. Both Diva and Jason said they would bet 30% for pretty much the same reasons that Andrew gave. So I'm pretty convinced that's the correct play. But anyway, I did check. So the turn came an offsuit 7. So the board now reads 7-6-4-3, still with 2 spades. And the big blind now bets half pot, roughly. 750 into 1550. The original razor quickly folds, and the action's on me.
Oh boy. Man, Fishy Pants Mavis says, I don't want to race, I don't want to fold. So, yeah, I think you're beat here sometimes, but not always. And even with, like, the river, probably you lose expected money on the river. Like, probably there are negative reverse implied odds here, but I think your immediate odds are more than good enough to justify, to outweigh that. So I would call. I think you're getting your price. What do you think, Andrew?
I mean, I wouldn't consider it terrible if you decided to make a, like, sole read fold, but I'm pretty sure I would call.
Yeah, to be honest, I took almost no time on this decision. I couldn't see any merit to raising, and I thought my hand was far too strong to fold. I think my hand is under-repped now after I've checked behind on the flop. And the big blind could certainly have reason to think now that he's ahead if he has nines, tens, or jacks. I'm getting 3-1, so it seemed a fairly clear call to me. So I did call. Then the river was the ace of diamonds, so the flush doesn't get there. But the ace obviously is not a good card for my specific hand.
Well, I mean, and against the big blind's range, the flush does get there, right? Like
Exactly. If he's bluffing a flush draw on the turn, he basically has presumably ace king or ace queen suited. So he thought for quite a while. And eventually bet 2,200 into 3,000. So quite a big bet. And then it's back to me.
Boy. It's tough. Tough spot. Well, you block a few of his value hands. Maybe. Maybe. You can't beat any value bets. If he's bluffing, he could see reason to bluff the river. It's hard for him to have too many bluffs on the turn. There's a four liner out on the turn, right? There's four to a straight on the turn, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he could have...
He can have eights for a gut shot.
Yeah. So he can have eights, and then he could be turning hand like eights into a bluff. Not sure about that. Would you ever peel the turn with a hand with an ace in it? That might be hard to do. Usually I would think that you could bluff catch those spots, but but given this board texture and the three-handedness of the pot, etc., I'm not sure you would ever peel the turn with ace king or ace queen. So you're pretty high up in your range, probably, but his range is a lot better than your range. So we're in a classic, difficult, no-limit situation. I think given the bet size, like, my gut says fold. I think I would fold. I think you're getting bluffed sometimes, but I think you pretty much have to. I don't know what I'm calling with. I think it's okay to make exploitive folds in this spot, especially if he might not know who you are. If I'm thinking about how somebody who's probably good would play against what looks like a sort of experienced European, you know, crafty live pro type, I'm not sure he's going to overbluff this river, but I could be wrong about that, and he might well underbluff it. I think I fold, but I don't have a great sense of how the situation breaks down theoretically, and I'm not sure folding is right. What would you do, Andrew?
I think the really tricky question is, if he's bluffing, what is he bluffing with? Maybe I misheard the board. It was 7-6-4-3 on the turn, right?
7-6-4-3 on the turn,
right? So eights isn't a gut shot. Or no, I think fives. Okay, I'm sorry.
Eights is
a gut shot.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe he has pocket eights that he's like turning into a bluff. But basically, to be bluffing, he has to be turning turning an overpair into a bluff. And with a hand like eights or nines, I think that's reasonable enough to do. There's still only so many combinations of those. And then, you know, is he turning like tens or jacks into a bluff compared to... I mean, I guess the question is, like, does he just bet ace-king or ace-queen on the turn if he doesn't have a flush draw? Because otherwise, you know, that pretty well limits the amount of ace x he could have. I wouldn't really expect him to ever have a five in his hand. So I mean, I suppose if he's good enough to recognize that like jacks or tens is pretty unlikely to be the best hand, it's actually not such an unreasonable spot for him to just turn those into a bluff, which, you know, could also explain the long river tank as him like convincing himself that jacks is no good and is one of his better bluffing candidates here, and that he wants to have a high bluffing frequency because, you know, you almost always have like exactly kings or queens, and he can rep the ace better than you can or something. But I think it's a bit of a parlay, even if he seems confident to say that he's capable of that much. And even then, I mean, it's not that he can't have an ace. So I think like even at equilibrium, like even if he's bluffing enough to have an optimal bluffing frequency, which I think requires a bit of skill and work to get there, it's still only a break-even call. Like, he has to be over bluffing before you make money on the call. And I just think that's a lot to ask for here.
Yeah, my thinking was, first of all, in terms of the actual my hand strength relative to his range, I thought a lot of his bluffs on the turn had an ace in them. He could be bluffing ace x of spades, or semi bluffing it, and now that's got there on the river, and he knows that. I think when players, my assumption was he didn't know who I was, and he just thought I was just some random older gentleman. And I think, and in my experience, American players just tend to view that type of player as very stationary, particularly on rivers. So
this is what I was trying to say.
Yeah, you were being very polite.
Older experience. Yeah, not older experience.
Yeah, so I felt he wouldn't feel very confident about being able to get me off queens or kings if he had jacks. I think he felt that somebody of my profile would still side call. So I felt, if anything, he would be under bluffing rather than over bluffing, and because I'm basically beating no value bets, and some of his semi bluffs on the turn got there now, I was pretty happy to fold, and I didn't give it too much thought, to be honest. I just couldn't see anything I was beating. Obviously, he could be good enough, as we said, to be turning eights, nines, jacks, tens, or jacks into a bluff, knowing that they're not going to be good enough on this board against my turn calling range, but I thought that was a bit of a reach to put him on those specific hands and then also assume that he would go for the bluff.
Yep. Well, I certainly like the river fold, so that's
yeah, there was unanimity among my group, apart from David, who's the biggest calling station in the world, who said he would definitely call the river. But then people do try to bluff more against David than they do against me, I think. So maybe it would be a correct call if it was David sitting in my seat.
Let me throw a quick one out as well. And this is just a pre-flop spot, so I think this won't require a lot of talk. But I ran it past Dara in the car this morning, and I was happy to see him grimace when I told him my hand, because that made me feel good about this. Just because I feel like I've been blinding off a lot at like, you know, a 25. Like 10 to 25 big blind stack, I've just been like very tight, and part of it is like card debt, but I'm kind of wondering like maybe I should, you know, this kind of goes through your head like, oh, maybe you should be playing more hands in this situation, maybe like you're giving raises too much respect or something. So this is at the Venetian tournament. The under the gun player has about a 15 big blind stack, something like that. He's a pretty weak recreational player. This is a little more detail than I gave Dara this morning. Previously, he's been quite splashy. He called a raise in early position with something awful, like 8-6 offsuit or something. He like called a raise under the gun one. We were much deeper at the time. So I think now with like 15 big blinds, I think he's conscious of the fact that he's raising a good chunk of his stack and that he's under the gun. Like, he's not that brain dead, but I'm not giving, you know, it's not like he has to be nutted to be raising off of a 15 big blind stack under the gun, I think. And I also don't know, you know, that he has an open shoving range the way some people might in that spot. So he opens like tiny 2.2 or something like that under the gun, and then a very good player in middle position calls, and I'm in the small blind with ace jack offsuit and exactly 10 big blinds.
That's pretty bad. That's gross.
That was exactly gross. My reaction.
Yeah, I fold, I think. Did you have any sense of, like, did you get any physical sense of what the under-the-gun player might be doing?
No, and I'm disappointed because he made a lot of faces. Like I was trying to watch him a lot, and he sometimes wore sunglasses and sometimes didn't. He made faces a lot. I felt like there was like definitely things going on tell wise, but I failed in making any sort of correlation. So the short answer is no.
And I think I missed this. How deep is the collar?
I don't recall, but I want to say probably 40 big blinds, something like that.
Yeah. Well, he just can't have, like, many worse faces. So if you go all... Man. By the way, as I'm saying this, Ryan Feast just shoved 1.5x pot with the nut low on the river, and it's awesome. And, like, seriously, the tank for, like, 5 minutes now. The whole thing is just... It's spectacular. It's great. I think Jason's going to call it off, in part, because he's got a tourist tournament to get back to. But, like, the scene is just, like... You know, for people sitting still, basically, one of them slightly grimacing, it's just the best television you can get. Oh, he folded. Okay. Anyway, that done. That done. Yeah, I mean, this is a poker stove question, right? I think 2.2. I think if you didn't pick up anything specifically, he's a little, like the original Razor's a little bit less likely to have ace-king, exactly. Or maybe aces or kings or queens. Like, I think there's some chance that this that this caps him a little bit if you didn't notice anything. It's, mm-hmm. It can be a dangerous way to reason, but I might slightly discount that. I think the caller should have a lot of, you know, ace queen, ace jack, but a lot of pairs. Like with pocket nines, what's he going to do? Pocket sixes, you might fold. With pocket jacks, he would probably re-raise. I think he should have some medium pairs and some like quite good unpaired hands. I'm not sure he's ever going to have like ace 10 offsuit though.
Maybe like king queen suited, queen jack suited.
Yeah,
Jackson's pushing a little bit.
Queen jack suited, I think. Yeah, I could definitely see him having king queen suited for sure.
Okay, well, if you think the caller can have king queen suited, there are ants. Is this present? There are antes. How big is the ante?
I believe this was 500, 1,000 with a 200 ante.
500, 1,000, 200 ante. Yeah, it's really close. I think it's a close shove. I think I don't see a good reason to call. I have a mistake. I think I overfold in these spots. I think whenever I really sit down and do poker stove on this stuff, it turns out like the antes and the blinds just really matter, and 10 big blinds is really shallow. And especially if there's some chance that you might have picked something up if the original Razor had a real big hand. I think you're gonna be off to the showers a lot when you shove, but I still think you have to shove.
I folded, and we didn't end up going to showdown, so no. I don't even remember what the flop was, to be honest. I folded.
Yeah, that's fine. I think it's close. I just my sort of higher order sense of what's going on here is that usually when is that I think if I went and stoved it and played around with it, I'd wind up side calling. That said, you have the button next, so that argues for turning some close calls into folds. But yeah, I think it's a very close show.
I realize we didn't give Dara a chance. I mean, I've heard Dara's input on this already, but we should give our audience the privilege.
Yeah,
I felt it was
actually a poker player. Yeah,
I felt it was a super close spot as well. I felt it was a very close fold. I just felt that we're not dominating enough of the calling range. Obviously, it's nice to get it in against king queen suited, but it's not like we're miles ahead in that spot either. I do think we can be dominated some of the time as well, and that seriously cuts our equity, given that we're almost never getting it in dominating. In these spots, I tend to also prefer getting it in with fold equity, and I don't think we're ever folding out the two guys here. I think at the very least the second guy is going to call it off. For those reasons I would just about fold, but I don't think the shove can be too bad either. I think it's almost the definition of a close spot. Like, I would definitely go with ace queen in this spot, and I wouldn't even be thinking about ace 10. So I think ace jack is somewhere around the line. Which side of the line it is, I'm not 100% sure. It obviously depends on the two guys' ranges. I also feel in a tournament where there are a lot of soft players, we should err more on the side of fold in these spots, yeah. Because we can get better spots even with a short stack. And to just to circle back to Andrew's original point that he has this general sort of sense of unease that he's folding too much in these spots. I think a lot of players get that when they, you know, find themselves short stacked. But my experience is that most people probably go the other way. They get a little bit too impatient and they just look down and they see two high cards and they stick it in without thinking about whether it's a really good spot or not.
Yeah.
Every time we do kind of essentially blind out of a tournament, we can feel that we've made a mistake, but that's not necessarily the case. It's not a massive disadvantage in equity terms to become short stacked. I mean, there's a reason why cash players don't like people who short stack. The shorter your stack gets, the more plus EV spots you're going to get anyway. So I don't think you necessarily have to force the action, even with 10 big blinds. So yeah, I just felt it's either a marginally profitable or marginally unprofitable spot. And in a tournament like this, I actually wouldn't mind passing a marginally profitable spot.
Good, good, good. And very importantly, Andrew, if there are listeners out there who want to get better at these marginal spots and are recognizing them and are making good decisions in them, is there a website that they might go to and subscribe to improve their skills?
Yeah, Tournament Poker Edge is the place if you want to, you know, some of these close spots we debate, but the most important thing is to make sure that when the spot isn't close, you're on the right side of it, right? The difference between calling or not calling, but shoving or folding in a spot like this one, not huge, but as Dara said, like ace-queen, you should definitely be sticking it in here. Ace 10, you should definitely be folding. And if you're ending up on the wrong side of those kinds of spots, you're costing yourself a lot. And a subscription to Tournament Poker Edge is one of the best ways to make sure you aren't ending up on the wrong side of that sort of spot. You can sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com.
Well, I should say, Dara, it's always an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It's a shame we won't get to see each other in person this year. I'll regret not seeing you, but yeah, it's been great talking to both of you.
Thanks, Nate.
Yeah, thanks for making time for us at the last minute. I think I'm planning on taking tomorrow off anyway. I guess you're going to play the Giant.
I'm going to play the Giant, which the flight doesn't start till 7 p.m. So I have most of the day off. I think we're hoping to record an interview with Andrew for my podcast with David Appin as well. So yeah, going to chill, continue my. Climatization and getting over the jet lag. I did literally go straight from the plane to play my first event.
Nice. That's a great feel. I love that. Isn't that great? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you don't like
it. I found that to be a questionable decision.
Yeah. I have to say I had no regrets. I felt I didn't make any mistakes in the tournament. And I felt that I was conscious of the fact that I might be prone to making mistakes. So I was particularly careful. So even though obviously I didn't last long enough in the tournament for it to be a major deal, I didn't regret the experiment, and it's an experiment I would repeat based on the way I felt afterwards. But certainly it was good to have yesterday off, and he's back into it today.
And then we've got Millionaire Maker coming up this weekend, so that's guaranteed to be a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I should let you guys go, but I'm sure our listeners will be intrigued. A podcast with you and David Lappin. Who would not want to listen to that? Where can everybody check you out?
We're the Chip Race. We're on SoundCloud and iTunes. Although we recently had a bit of a kerfuffle, we interviewed two particularly sweary Brits and didn't remove all of their cuss words. So we were up on iTunes, and then we were pulled from iTunes for a while. So I think we need to put an explicit label on or something. But yeah, we just finished our second season with interviews with Tatjana Pasiak, William Kasouf, David van der Hayden, who's the Unibet ambassador, and Kev Math, who we also had on a previous episode as well. So yeah, check us out on SoundCloud or iTunes.
Dara, David, too hot for iTunes. Check it out.
All right, good night. Well,
yeah, take care. Nice take care. Pleasure as always.
Sleepless nights, do I need some kind of pill? Or the devotion of a Carmelite? Or the fair passage of a bill? And who will sign us into law? I know you won't.